Radio Vermont, WDEV, takes no responsibility for the opinions or statements made by the House Calls Vermont show host or their guests. The information provided during the House Calls Vermont show is offered only as a public service and should not be used as a substitute for obtaining any professional advice from a licensed professional.
WDEV presents House Calls Vermont with hosts Jim Bradley and Chris West. Each week, a new topic specific to building or renovating in the Green Mountains and your phone calls. Brought to you by RK Miles, a third-generation family-owned business. Proud to be your local building material supplier. Find a location near you at rkmiles.com. By Poly Construction, for over 30 years known for anything construction. Big or small jobs, one call does it all. Poly Construction, P-O-L-L-I Construction.com. By Ken Libby of the Stowe Area Realty Group at Keller Williams Stowe, your trusted advisor. Give Ken a buzz at 802-793-2002. By Curtis Lumber with two locations in Vermont, Williston and Burlington. Request a quote for your next project online at curtislumber.com. Sticks and Stuff in Swanton Lumber, with locations in St. Albans, Enosburg, Swanton, Derby, and Middlesex. By Shamrock Painting, painting and custom wood finishing, shamrockpainting.com. By Matt Clark's Northern Basement Systems, for all things basement-y, northernnefoundations.com. Your participation today is encouraged. Call the listener line with questions at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 1-877-291-8255. Now, House Calls Vermont with Jim and Chris.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Jim Bradley, and I'm here with my friend and colleague, Chris West.
Hey, everybody.
Hey, today on the House Calls Vermont, we're actually on our first remote broadcast.
On the road.
On the road. House Calls on the road. So we're making a house call.
A house call.
But we're here at Sticks and Stuff in St. Albans, and Sticks and Stuff is one of our sponsors, and we're here today to do the remote broadcast, and if should anybody come by with questions, certainly stop by the booth here, and we'll be willing to answer those.
We're down in the kitchen area.
The Kitchen Idea Center, as they're calling it, which is a beautiful place, by the way. It's a newer facility. It's been open for the last couple of years, but it has great examples of what you can see, how the kitchen might look, your mudrooms, cabinetry throughout the house. It's a great place to get some great ideas.
Absolutely. And I just want to say, driving into St. Albans this morning, in the main drag, the square right on Main Street, there's a big Halloween kind of setup.
So, festivities,
yeah. If you're in the area, I highly recommend it. I saw a whole family of ninjas crossing the street in front of my car on the way over.
Very common in St. Albans, I hear.
The ninja thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Is that why you were late? You were in the bouncy house?
That's right.
I went to the
bouncy castle.
Wonderful. But here at Sticks and Stuff in St. Albans, this is their flagship store, and they do have five locations throughout Vermont. There's one in Derby. There's one in Enosburg. There's also one in Middlesex. And also, they are owners now of the Swanton Lumber, just one exit away from us north. And with that, Sticks and Stuff is a locally owned Vermont business.
Which we are huge fans of, locally owned.
Definitely. Jeff Lanfear and Chris Bullock are the owners. Apparently what I've heard is that they literally started from the ground floor of this company with broom in hand, sweeping the ground floor as
employees. So if you want a job here, show up with a broom.
And maybe one day you'll
own the place.
But they do have 170 employees throughout their network of stores. So definitely a great Vermont employer here. And what they've done is, in this showroom here, they've made great efforts to be able to reach out to the public and offer so much more as far as different ideas with the Kitchen Design Center, also their flooring center. In their Kitchen Design Center alone, they have six different design experts to help you with your design and your plans for your remodeling or new build project. Whether you're going to be a do-it-yourselfer or you're going to hire your own contractor, they're going to be able to let you pick things out, see what it's going to look like, even help you with some of the plans that you would have for the construction. In their flooring center, very similar. They have six different professionals that can help you in your flooring needs. And when I say flooring, I don't just mean the like LVT, luxury vinyl tile, or LVP, luxury vinyl planks, but your traditional click-together floors, wood floor refinishing, also tile. You know, whether that's a tile shower, tile backsplash, tile flooring. They have the experts here, so come on down, talk with them, let them know what you're thinking for your design plans, and they can help you make your selections. So it's a really great offering here.
Yeah, and we were very thankful to be able to do our first live remote here at the Sticks and Stuff in Swanton. I did want to just bring up that the first episode that we had, 3 weeks ago. This is episode 4 of the new season.
Yep.
I brought up keeping a journal to, because we're getting inside our houses, we're closing our houses up, and it's at this point when it can become obvious if you have indoor air quality issues.
Yes.
Because we're changing where we're getting our ventilation air, where we're getting our hygienic air. Before, when we had the windows open at night, we're now closing them up, and then if you can, you know, if people start complaining about sniffles, if they start complaining about being tired when they wake up in the morning, in order to keep track of that, we're asking people to keep a journal. It can be a piece of paper, it can be a spreadsheet, it can be whatever you want. But if you're not going to, usually when we come to an audit and we find bad indoor air quality,
yes,
then we ask the client, do you people, or people coming home and they're tired at night, or they're waking up groggy, or people getting sick when you start coming indoors, and they give us kind of, yeah, I kind of have a feeling that that was happening, but if you keep a journal, then you can look at it and have actual data. You know, did you notice that your kids, like Jim has that story about his kids getting sick in his house every time the heating season started, and he found out that there was a perfectly good reason for that.
Mold.
There was back mold in the attic, yes, that was recirculating back into the house. So we can use this type of a journal to just give us an idea if there is something going on that may be related to closing up the house for the heating season.
Yeah, and you know, with that, when we're going into this, we're you know, into a home performance assessment for somebody or an energy audit, we're looking for some of these indicators, whether that be mold in some areas. But then if we start finding some of those things, what we're going to do then is we're going to look at the fact of, are there any other health issues that people may realize? There was one house we were in recently that we noticed some issues, but then we noticed in one of the bedrooms there was an inhaler for asthma.
Right.
And so we started asking questions, and I've been into these places before where you'll say, does anybody have asthma or respiratory issues or headaches? And the hands will start to go up. There was this one house that we worked on in Sheldon that I found a huge, the whole wall was rotten on the outside, and the vinyl siding on the outside hid that fact, but we found a water source and from the leakage and everything else. And
bulk
then the
water infiltration,
yes,
into the assembly.
And then the rotting of the assembly. But then when we explained to the customer what was happening, the one of the spouses said, oh, that's why I always have a headache when I sit in that room. And she she was not able to sit in that room and watch TV with everybody because she would get a headache because she was more sensitive than most.
Right.
And so this is why when we talk about some of these things, when you're weatherizing your home, it's not just that saving money on your energy bills. It's not just protecting your investment, which you definitely want to do, but it's the whole health and safety component.
Absolutely.
You know, you may call us about efficiency or one of the contractors on the EEN list for the Efficiency Excellent Network with Efficiency Vermont, and you may ask them first about efficiency, but you also need to realize that the work being done, you have to look at the house once again as a system. Yes, and make sure all these components are done appropriately, because just throwing more insulation in the attic or making something tighter inside the house and not giving deference or consideration to these items could be dangerous.
Yeah. So keep that journal. Keep a list of things that happen in your house with the health of your family, but also comfort issues of people like, you know, I'm in that room and I'm cold. These are all good things to have a history, data on the history of it when someone like Jim and I come in and we say, do you have this? And they're not like just, yeah, I remember somebody mentioning something, but here on this date, this person said this. And so that's a great idea.
Or the example we used last week for the heating systems for the customer that was right up here in St. Albans. Albans that every time he would do have laundry day, he would get really, really tired. Not because the event of doing laundry or that he was allergic to it. It's right. just that he was using more of the heating appliance. And it in that, it was
depressurizing the house.
Yes, depressurizing the house, bringing more of the system was already backdrafting. So he was being affected by that.
Yeah,
by
the heating system was backdrafting. Yep. And by depressurizing the house with the dryer, he was sucking that bad non-combusted or flue gases into the house. So we want to make sure that if you're talking to someone like us, you've got some actual information. I did want to say we've just posted the video of our first episode onto our YouTube channel, and I also uploaded an interview with John Rockwell from Zender.
Yes.
That is a company that makes ERVs and HRVs. Great interview. It's about 35, 40 minutes long. Just a spoiler alert, John and I are both trained operatic singers, so we chat about that a little. He's got an actor.
And I just thought you were a theatrical electrician.
Jim's got this great cartoon idea for me as an electrician who does things theatrically. No, my dad actually worked on Broadway as an electrician in the theater, but theatrical electrician can be taken a number of ways. So if you're interested, we also have the audit eavesdropping where you can watch over our shoulder while we're doing an audit, and we also have the Old Stage Road Deep Energy Retrofeed updates, and soon coming to the YouTube channel will be the Tiny House Retrofit, and Jim and I are actually going to the Tiny House after the show today to do some more work on it, and we'll give you updates on that.
Yes, and getting back a little bit sticks and stuff here and what some of the things are offering. When you're a homeowner and you're looking, as we've talked about here so often, as you're doing a project by yourself, a DIY project, remember, we want to do it yourself, not destroy it yourself. And so sometimes you have to ask, where are we going to get great information? You know, so how do we choose our products carefully? How do we source them? And what do we need on that estimate list? And what if we need some light engineering services and everything else, whether you're, just a standard consumer or you're a contractor doing work for somebody else? Sticks and Stuff has those offerings for their clientele. And so you can come in here, you can speak to their staff. One of their estimators will help you to make sure you get the materials list correct, because you don't maybe not know how many 2x4s you're going to need to build that structure, or some of the sequencing that you may have to look at for some of the materials and how you should source those and when they should be at the project and everything else. These people can help you here, you know, and that's what they offer to their clients. And so certainly if you have a project coming up and you're in the area, go by one of their facilities and engage with one of them to help you in the process so you get the boxes checked appropriately, and you can do it right the first time, whether you're a contractor or just a regular consumer alike.
Yep. And just before we're coming up to a break, but I just wanted to bring up, we've gotten a couple of emails from people.
Great.
There was one email from Corrine who said, I heard you guys. You guys are great. We love you. We're glad you're back on the air. You said something about carbon dioxide monitors. Could you give us a kind of flew by me? Could you give us that again? So the whole point about the carbon monoxide monitors is you can buy the Kidde, KIDDE, ones that are
First Alert.
That don't have a readout on them, but those kick in at 30.
Actually, 50. I just read it again. It was 35 parts per million. Now it's 50 parts per million sustained for at least 90 minutes.
Right.
So, but
which is higher than we should be allowing.
At 9 parts per million. That's when the human being or the human physiology has really started to be adversely affected at 9 parts per million and above. And so if you're taking this in, especially on a regular basis, I don't know how many houses I've been into, Chris, where I see the CO detector disconnected. And I said, okay, what's wrong with there? Well, it kept going off.
Right.
There's a reason why. You know, and I had one customer.
That's alarming.
That's a very alarming. And you may not wake up if your alarm goes off.
That's right.
If you ignore it. But every time they would use their cook stove was triggering it. But they just got annoyed by it. Instead of looking deeper into the problem, and when I tested the unit, the stove needed to be red tagged and thrown out.
Right.
It was irreparable.
Right.
So, you know, get the right type of device. Yes, get something that's going to be more sensitive. You can go online. Google will have several offerings for you.
Or come down to Sticks and Stuff.
Sticks and Stuff offers them too.
Yep.
You just want to make sure that the one that you're purchasing, you're getting the right type that's going to be more sensitive and has a digital readout.
Yep.
So if it's going off, you can see, is this a catastrophic event,
right,
or is just a little bit you know, elevated levels.
And I do want to just jump in and remind people the difference between carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide. So carbon dioxide is what we breathe out as part of the metabolic processes of living things. And if you have a high carbon dioxide problem, you can go out into the fresh air in a couple of breaths and you're all better.
Exactly.
What carbon monoxide does is it actually fills the whole, the red blood cell, and that red blood cell will never be usable for oxygen again. That
exactly.
has to die and be replaced either through an infusion or through natural bone marrow transfer and new red blood cells. So if you have a carbon monoxide poisoning event, you can run outside and breathe all you want, and you could still die from carbon monoxide.
That's
so
very
carbon,
dangerous.
Much more dangerous than carbon dioxide.
And it becomes more of a concern once we start closing everything
That's
up for
right.
the winter. And so once again, replace those batteries. We've got the time change coming up this next weekend. And
it's a great time to
Change those batteries, make sure everything's working appropriately, and vacuuming out your current carbon monoxide and fire detector. But right now, we're coming up onto our first break, so please join us when we come back. And in the meantime, give us a call with any of your do-it-yourself questions, your building questions, building science questions, at 802-244-1777. See you after the break.
Christmas Eve Then and Now by Wythe Windows. Christmas Eve Then.
And Mama in her kerchief and I in my cap had just settled our brains for a long winter's nap.
Tighten up that kerchief. It's going to be a cold one.
It's that nasty draft from the window that's to blame.
Away to the window I flew like a flash, tore open the shutters and threw up the sash.
Hurry, I think I see something.
It's stuck.
And Christmas Eve Now.
Look, it's Santa. What a clear, unobstructed view we get through our Wythe windows. Quick, tilt it open.
Hey, Santa, it's Jim.
Those are some good-looking Wythe tilt-and-turn windows.
I know. 8 locking points keep them air and watertight, and they're made in New Jersey.
That's my next stop. I have a new guitar for the boss.
I heard him exclaim as he drove out of sight,
Wythe windows for all, for a house cozy and tight.
Wythe windows, high-performance passive house windows and doors. Online at WYTHEWindows.com.
Welcome back to House Calls Vermont. I'm Jim Bradley here with Chris West.
Hey, guys.
Hey, we're here once again in the flagship store of Sticks and Stuff in St. Albans, Vermont, doing our first live remote on site. And so if you're in the area, I'd like to stop down and ask us a question. Please feel free to do so or give us a call at 802-244-1777. And this week, we are definitely into the throes of cooler temperatures. And we talked last week about heating systems, and we had a few that we had to finish up on that we will get back to a little bit later. But right now, you know, what we're looking at is normally at this time we would have somebody on from Efficiency Vermont, and making those schedules meet up this year has been a little more challenging. But there are changes afoot with Efficiency Vermont, and we're going to be able to talk about those more as our shows progress, and we might even have more information next week because some of their offerings, some of the rebates are changing that a homeowner can take advantage of by weatherizing their home. But once again, we always point you in the direction of going to their website, looking for an EEN contractor that is trained in this field, knows what to look for, can stop by your house, perform a really great assessment to allow you to get a laundry list of things that either you can do partially on your own, mostly by on your own, or you can have them do for you. If you did want to do some of these projects on your own, you can come down to a place like Sticks and Stuff here in St. Albans or one of their other various locations and buy things like the weather stripping and the caulking and all types of insulation, whether it be the bat insulation that goes in the cavities or rigid board insulation or some of the foam products that you may need to do comprehensive air sealing. You could look for tools, all those great power tools that you need an excuse to buy. They have those here. Once again, we talked about smoke detectors, but also LED bulbs, which will help you save on your energy bill at the same time. So, but with that, if you do a project on your own, Efficiency Vermont's rebates are still allowing for a $100 rebate back to homeowners off the cost of some of the materials that you're going to purchase and make some of those changes.
I also got an email the other day from Efficiency Vermont showing rebates for LED lights and other mm-hmm. types of efficiency that you can easily do by yourself in your house, just swapping out an incandescent light with LEDs. I think even Philips stopped making incandescent lights recently. There's a couple of people I've seen reports hoarding these incandescent lights because they're just not going to be available for very much longer.
Well, when LEDs first came out, they were problematic. I mean, the light temperature wasn't great.
Yeah, it made you feel like blue.
Yes, it made you feel like you're in a sterile environment. It wasn't great. But they've improved so much, and now there's you could have a disco machine going with all these colored lights flashing because they're programmable. I have some that I can operate right from my phone in my house. And
when he's not home.
When I'm not home and cause my family to wonder what's going on. But so
or your neighbors.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, they've really advanced since then, and so it's worth the investment to go that direction. At this time, one thing that we didn't get to completely last week was going to be all the different heating systems and cooling systems that are available.
We got through most of them. We got through forced hot air systems. We got through boiler systems.
Yes.
And we talked about the difference between the heating plant and the distribution system, right? Whether you have a radiator or whether you have a forced hot air duct, those types of things. We talked about fireplaces and how you need to have those checked on the annual basis.
I finally fired mine up, so made sure it was working appropriately and everything else. And then, so our heating system is on somewhat this year. So,
we went down the list of them, but we didn't get to heat pumps.
Cold climate heat pumps, yes. And like those, one thing that we have to emphasize on those previous systems is maintenance. Get them maintained. Right. Get them serviced because you want them operating safely, efficiently. And when it comes to some of these we're going to talk about next, you've got to make sure the filters are clean and that they're properly maintained.
Yep. So a heat pump is a technology that we've had since the 1950s. Mm-hmm. Heat pumps are use what's known as the Carnot cycle. It's easily the most efficient way to take an energy and get it moved over to another type of use. So if you're going to look at your boiler is taking a material and it's burning it. That has a maximum efficiency of 100%. You can't get more out of that system than that 100%. Well, a heat pump, your refrigerator is a heat pump, your air conditioner in your window is a heat pump. It's taking the same technology, and what it does is it has a refrigerant in it that boils at negative 55 or negative 56 degrees Fahrenheit, mm-hmm. which means that if you have outside temperature air that's 20 degrees, minus 20 or above, that's actually warm enough to boil this refrigerant, which means that we can get efficiencies above 100% because we're taking heat from an outside source. We're adding external heat. So the air-to-air heat pumps that are available right now on the market are about 400% efficient.
They're definitely getting up there. In fact, now the biggest problem with them is they didn't used to operate down at a low enough temperature.
Right.
So once you got below 5 degrees Fahrenheit, your efficiency started dropping off, and you get to 12 to 15 to 18 degrees below zero, and they wouldn't be able to function anymore. The higher heat pumps, the HAIER, is one type of heat pump that currently is purporting operational temperatures down to negative 30 degrees Fahrenheit,
right.
Which in Vermont, you're pretty safe that you're going to be able to still effectively use that because we don't have sustained negative 30 degree temperatures anymore, and so that's something to look at.
So when we're talking about heat pumps, one of the things we'll talk about on the tiny house discussions is that the builder who built this tiny house put in a heat pump that only worked down to like 30 degrees Fahrenheit, and the owner who owned the tiny house before we bought it from them to renovate was able to use the warranty when their heat pump died, and it died because it was trying to
work
too below hard. Temperature. And he was in Burlington where we have minus 10 degree temperatures on a regular basis. Fortunately, it was a very small space. It's only 280 square feet. So their body heat and their dogs, and they had a little resistant heater, that was enough to keep that warm. But if you're going to have a heat pump installed, the Efficiency Vermont programs have been pushing that, which I'm a big fan of. I like electrification of the grid. I think it's a good way to move away from fossilized fuels, which is still probably going to take another 30, 40 years to completely get away from. But if you have a heat pump, make sure you're having that heat pump installed. Make sure that before you get a heat pump installed that you have an energy audit done. There are houses that are better suited for heat pumps and some that are worse. And one of the, we have a colleague who used to call us on a regular basis going, I'm going to put heat pumps in this house, but I want to know whether this is a good fit.
Right? Exactly.
We're not just going to throw a heat pump in every house because there's a rebate on it. That's not a good idea.
Or we like to tell people, and I've used this so many times, someone thinks, okay, what do I do first in the matter of priorities? If your heating system is defunct, right, then that's the time to possibly replace that. You need to stay warm. But with that, if it's not the issue and it's not the presenting issue, why would you not want to address areas in the home that are causing that warm conditioned air,
yep,
to heat out, you know, to heat the outdoors really effectively and really efficiently with a really efficient system that you're going to put in? So you,
right,
may put a 94% efficient or 96% efficient boiler in, or you put these heat pumps in. But if you do that and you haven't addressed the rest of the structure, you're not, the priorities are a little out of whack.
Right. So there is a mantra in energy efficiency, and it's kind of based on the recycling one. Reduce your load, mm-hmm, then you want to use high efficiency systems,
yes,
and after that you go to
renewables,
right?
Yep.
So those are the three prongs, but the first one is reduce. Have someone like,
yes,
Jim and I come in, try to look at what can be done to reduce the load of the house. And the load is how many BTUs per hour at your lowest temperature, right? So if you have a house that's really leaky, that isn't very well insulated, and leaky is more important than well insulated, right? Infiltration is the biggest loss of a house. So reduce that uncontrolled, breezes coming through your house, your drafts.
Yes.
That's the biggest thing to fix. And the depending on your house, we can't say without seeing, usually it's the attic that needs to be addressed first.
Yeah.
And then the basement, like we were talking about last year, the ABCs, attic, basement, and then the conditioned spaces in between. And put your efforts into that, because if you put a bunch of money into heat pumps, but your house is still leaky, that heat pump is not going to heat your house any better than any other system because your house still has that same load. It may do it for slightly less money because the efficiencies of that unit, but we got to start by reducing the load.
And we've seen a lot of times when people have a really leaky structure, the heat tech may want to ensure that they don't get a
call
when it gets to very, very cold temperatures. And
everybody's calling.
And everyone's calling.
Right, right.
So what they'll do is many times, oversize the unit. Well, when you do that and you oversize the unit, it can cause the unit, if it doesn't need that much heat, it can short cycle. So it's going to cause the actual heating unit to function,
less efficiently,
yep, and too often. And so it's going to wear that system down. So as Chris said, get that house, tightened up first, make sure it's appointed well, the health and safety measures are checked off, and then put the properly sized system in, and it's going to last a lot longer.
Yep. So heat pumps come in a couple of different varieties. You've got your air-to-air heat pump, and those come in two varieties. One is that was called the regular mini split, where you,
yes,
have one outside unit and one inside unit. That inside unit is often called a wall wart, and those are what we need to clean. So if you have a non-ducted system, which is what I'm describing, the other is a ducted system, which is a heat pump that has one central head, and that head then feeds ducts that then feed that warm air or cold air, because heat pumps can do heating and cooling. It's one of the things we love about them. Those have to be cleaned on a regular basis. Now, the actual heat pump head needs to be cleaned once every three or four years, but the filters on it need to be cleaned on a monthly basis at the minimum. The manufacturer actually recommends every 2 weeks that they get cleaned when they are in use. And we were in a house not so long ago in Morrisville where we said to the client, you've had this heat pump in for 5 years, how often do you clean the filters? And they looked at us and said, filters?
Exactly. That happens far too often. Right now we're going to go to our phones. We have a call in Worcester from Stuart. Stuart, welcome today. What is your question?
I'm listening to your earlier explanation of heat transfer from the outside air to evaporating your refrigerant. If your refrigerant evaporates at minus 55 and the temperature outside is minus 20, then you have 35 degrees of temperature to work with. Are you actually getting the same amount of heat out of your heat pump when the temperature is 20 below than when the temperature is 20 above, with a greater difference between the air temperature and
the boiling point. Yeah, it is a great point. The delta T affects the efficiency of the unit. So when we look and the output, right? So if we're talking about a heat pump that can go down to minus 20, if you're looking at that same heat pump at 30 degrees, the heat pump is probably going to be operating at its maximum efficiency or close to its maximum efficiency, somewhere around, you know, 300% efficient, or COP of 3, and the output of the unit would be 100% of what it can put out. When you get down to that near shutoff temperature of minus 20, that unit is going to be putting out probably 50% of its nominal output and probably be running at 100% efficiency. So the efficiency is much lower because that delta T is so much smaller. So you're absolutely right. That's why when we're sizing these units, we make sure that the unit is sized for, you know, double whatever that minimum load is for the house. So if your house is 32,000 BTUs at 20 degrees and it's 60,000 BTUs at minus 20, then we size for the 60,000 BTUs so that you'll have enough capacity to heat the house. So you're absolutely right. Heat pumps go down in efficiency and output as the temperatures get colder, but we compensate for that by making sure the unit is big enough to handle that change in efficiency and change in output.
But catch what Chris said, too.
Maybe you could explain the word efficiency a little bit. I'm thinking about the law of conservation of energy.
Sure.
Energy is never created or destroyed. It's only transferred from one place or one form to another.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is this 400% efficiency? You're not creating four times more energy than is available, are you?
No. So when we're talking about the efficiency of a system, we draw a circle around it, right? And we say these are the things we're including in that calculation. When you're dealing with something like a fuel-burning material like propane or wood or whatever, that can only give you as much BTUs as is in the actual physical material, right? And but with a heat pump, we're drawing a circle around it that includes the outside air. We're using the relative heat in the outside air to add heat into the system, which is how we can get, you know, above that, that what 100%. Every kilowatt is going to give you a certain amount if it was straight electric, which is what basically the heat pump is working at that minus 20 degrees. But if you start being able to borrow heat from the environment around you, then you can say, based on that 100%, I'm actually bringing in heat, and that increases the efficiency compared to a fuel that you're actually burning. So you're drawing your box around a different set. You're not just drawing it around the heating box of the boiler. You're actually saying, I've got the heating box of the boiler, but I'm also able to add heat from outside. It's just like if I was to say my house is able to heat, if I'm doing a load calculation, based on the amount of the delta T, the outside temperature, the inside temperature. But if I'm able to capture sunlight, then I'm actually able to heat my house with that, and that changes the load calculation. So I'm changing the box that I'm drawing. I'm not just calculating the actual heat loss from inside the building. I'm also saying I'm capturing sunlight. So what it really depends on where you're drawing the boundaries of the system that you're describing, right? And that's how we can get above 100% efficiency, because we're stealing heat from the air outside.
But when you're operating at 100% efficiency, you're only getting a tiny amount of heat because the air outside only has
is so low. Exactly, right.
Amount. Is this analogous to those old calorimetry experiments students did in high school?
I'm sorry, you broke up a little. Could you repeat that question?
You know, is the operation of a heat pump similar to calorimetry experiments where
yes where you yeah Very well said. So a calorimetry experiment is where, in order to figure out how many calories are in, say, a peanut, we probably all did this in elementary or high school chemistry, you take that peanut and you burn it in a particularly well-insulated situation, and then you can count the number of calories. Well, if you add heat from another source, that reading is going to be off because there's extra heat coming from somewhere else throwing that reading off. So you wouldn't just get the peanut, you'd get the peanut plus, you know, wherever that extra source was coming from. So you're absolutely right on that. Okay, Stuart, thank you very much for the call.
Okay.
Yeah, you know what? If I'd love to continue this discussion, send us an email at housecallsvt@gmail.com, and we can continue this off the line. But we have another caller
Now. Yeah, Dwight in Burlington. Go ahead, Dwight.
Dwight, are you there? Can we?
Okay, do we have Peter in Calais?
Oh,
there we go. Dwight?
Okay, Dwight, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Sorry, we're having some slight technical difficulties. Go ahead.
Okay. Can you hear me? Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. I said this call is a lot, my question is a lot less technical. So I live in a 1930s vintage house in Burlington, and it has the old-fashioned forced hot water radiators and no duct work anywhere. And what is the current kind of arc of the technology for providing a replacement for a natural gas fired boiler to actually heat water and supply hot water to those radiators without having to go to hot air and having to put ductwork and all that in?
That's a great question. The way that radiators work are you have a certain size of the surface area of that radiator, and that needs a certain temperature water in order to create the BTUs to heat that room, right? So the length of radiator that's in there is coupled with probably a 190 degree water supply temperature. If you were to put a different way to heat that water, and one of the popular ways is an air-to-water heat pump or a ground source heat pump. Those heat pumps top out at about 130 degree temperature water. So you would have to change the type of radiator you have in order to have a larger service area to put the same BTUs per hour into that room. So one possible way to go, I mean, you could still use those radiators, but then you'd need to reduce the load of the house by increasing the insulation on the outside. So it's kind of like how much do you want to invest to still use the same old radiator with a more efficient technology. If you want to get that 190 degree temperature water, the only way to do that is either to use a boiler or
high efficiency
boiler or a pellet stove or something that's actually burning something. These heat pumps, they're great for a lot of things, but the efficiencies go down the higher temperature water you're asking for them.
I see. Could I ask one more question?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. Finish the question.
If you had to look into your crystal ball, what, given the fact that there's so many houses from the 30s and the 20s in Burlington, and you know that there's going to be pressure to get off fossil fuel in the next 10 years and beyond, what do you think is the technology that will be recommended to people like myself?
I think the first technology is exactly what we said before, which is making your house more energy efficient so it has a lower load so that it can take less BTUs to heat that room, and maybe you could use the same infrastructure.
And we're going to get back to answering that question after the break because we actually had that on our agenda, Dwight, to actually talk about emerging technology. So we'll be back to that after the break.
Thanks for calling,
though.
And we'd love to follow up. Give us an email at housecallsvt@gmail.com.
But right now we have a caller, Peter from Calais. Go ahead, Peter, with your call, and welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. It's good to hear you back. I have a question. I had a house fire, and so part of my house is being rebuilt, and part of it we're redoing. And we had the blown-in cellulose, and all that was pulled out because of the fire and all the sheetrock and everything. And my wife was talking to a guy from Efficiency Vermont, He was saying that you might that we might consider using the blown-in polyurethane foam instead of the rock wool and the you know the dense pack cellulose. What do you guys think about that? That the blown-in polyurethane foam.
So a little bit more information would be helpful, Peter. What type of attic do you have? Is it a flat attic? Is it a slope ceiling? What
or is it walls? Is it everything?
Exactly. Is it walls as well?
Attic. Yeah, flat attic and the walls.
Okay. And,
the new part will be 6-inch. And the old
part. Okay, so the walls are a 6-inch cavity.
Yeah, right.
Okay, and with that, are the walls, is the siding off on the outside? Was that part
no,
of it? Or what got
no,
gutted completely
no,
in
the,
what remains?
So we're a little bit of both. The older part of the house that got gutted has clapboards on the outside. The new part, you know, will just have, you know, will be new. It'll be 2x6s, and then we'll put on, we were thinking of using the zip board with the tape on them on the outside, besides the regular sheathing.
Sure. Personally, what I would recommend is, you know, granted foam does have twice the R value as your cellulose or your fiberglass or even your Roxul. So that's why people do like to maximize the R value of the cavity. There are some safeguards that you have to address. Like if you have new framing, you want to make sure the moisture content's correct. Because let's say you go ahead and spray the whole cavity, but the moisture content was higher than 19%, and then it starts to dry out over time, the wood will shrink, pull away, make a small crack, but that's enough for condensation to start to form and rot out the OSB sheathing and cause some really catastrophic things for your building structure and the health and safety of the occupants, because if it starts to mold and everything else. And so that is one consideration. Dense packing, if you dense pack that wall, you're usually going to get about an R 3.5 to 3.7 per inch. And if it's done appropriately, that can be a really sound measure. What we like to see is not just cavity insulation, but if there is an opportunity, maybe on the new part of the structure, to be able to put exterior insulation as well, that would be great. Go ahead.
We were going to do the one-inch, what they call it, zip board. It's an insulation board on the outside.
Yeah. I have real hesitations with that, and this is why. It's the whole profile of percentage of outboard insulation and inboard insulation. And your outboard insulation, you shouldn't break the rule of thumb of 50%, 50%. So you should have at least 50% outside. In some cases.
And that's the R value split. So
if
your whole wall is an R25, then you would want 13. R13 outside and R13 between your studs, right? I would also that's because we want to keep that first condensing layer, the first thing that moisture that's going to move through your wall is going to hit. We want to keep that above the dew point so we don't get condensation inside your wall.
Exactly.
Now, I'm going to be a little devil advocate here. I do not like using spray foam in walls. I think it's not the right place for it. I think spray foam is a great material and it has its applications. It does have a slightly higher R value. It's about, you know, like Jim was saying, 30% more or something per inch. But in the end, it's vapor closed, right? So if you're going to spray foam your walls and some moisture gets trapped behind it, there's nowhere for that to dry to.
And then you get the zip wall there. The OSB itself with the glues in it is going to be a vapor retarder as well. So that can create a vapor sandwich profile, and that's not going to be a great situation.
So, Peter, I'd love to dive a bit deeper into this. It's only so much we can do in this format. So send me an email at housecallsvt@gmail.com, and I'd like to dive a bit deeper into your project. Okay?
Especially your attic.
Super.
We want to talk to you
thank
about
you.
Air sealing in the attic and everything else.
All
that'd be great.
We got to run to a
all
break right now, but thank you for calling, Peter.
Sure thing, Thanks, sir.
And if you have... Yeah, you're very welcome. If you have any questions, give us a call at 802-244-1777, 802-244-1777. And right now, this is House Calls Vermont, taking a break.
Hey,
Hey, this is Chris West back from our break. It's House Calls Vermont with my colleague Jim Bradley.
Hello again.
So we were just having a phone call with Peter, and I just wanted to tie a bow on that. And we've spoken about the first condensing layer before.
Yes.
And this is a very important concept in our climate. If you lived in Georgia, it wouldn't matter because there's no amount of temperature that's going to create an inside condensation risk in that wall.
Not Georgia, Vermont.
Not Georgia, Vermont. Georgia, the state.
Yes.
And not Georgia in Europe,
yes,
right?
True.
and vapor drive is a hard concept to wrap your head around, but it's happening every day that you have a higher concentration of moisture on one side of a wall and a lower concentration of moisture on the other side. Just think about it as heat, but instead of as the heat, we're talking about gaseous water in the air. So in the wintertime, in the heating season, it's moister inside your house than it is outside of your house.
Yes.
So the moisture, and there's no way to stop this, moves gaseous water through the sheetrock in your wall, through the fibrous insulation in your wall, fiberglass or cellulose or whatever, and it's going to hit whatever that first solid layer is. Just like the outside of your glass of iced tea in the summer, you're going to get condensation if that surface is below the dew point. And the dew point that we're talking about for 7-degree temperature and 40% relative humidity is 57.3 degrees Fahrenheit. So we want to try to make sure that that surface is above that dew point. The reason that we don't want to spray foam or that we don't recommend using spray foam in a wall cavity is because of the things that Jim was talking about. You have failures. This is the only insulation that's actually mixed on site. And some of the worst failures that we've seen in buildings is a poorly installed and applied spray foam assembly.
Especially where the details are missed. I mean, when you have framing pieces that are sistered together or married together.
Put next to each other and
exactly.
Nailed together.
And then when the wood shrinks, you get this gap. And then you get the vapor drive will not be denied. It's going to happen.
Yep.
And so you think you're getting a really sound assembly, but if the details aren't addressed appropriately, you're going to have failure. So that's why we're a little bit hesitant. In fact, as we were tearing apart the tiny house,
yep,
we found so many cavities that looked presented nicely, that they were well insulated. You get behind there, and there was the striation in the foam where there were gaps behind it up to an inch, which was not getting the whole R value of the assembly because
right,
there was a foam failure.
And probably helping with the failure and the increase in moisture in that wall.
Exactly.
So we don't recommend spray foaming an assembly. The good news is the new code says that you don't have to build with 2x6s, right?
Yeah.
We went to 2x6s in the 1980s and 1990s because we wanted to increase the R value.
Exactly.
It's not structural at all.
Yes.
You can still build a perfectly good structure out of 2x4s 24 on center and not have any structural issues well into the life of the building,
exactly,
all the way to the end of the life of the building. When you're building a building right now, and this is what I'm going to tell Peter who called in from Callis, that new part of the building, don't build it with a 2x6. Build it with a 2x4. Fill that with the dense pack cellulose or rock wool or even fiberglass. That's going to be an R13. Well, we have to hit an R26 for code. That means we can put foam on the outside, rigid board, even that half zip, the R-zip that they have, with 2 inches of polyiso on the outside,
mm-hmm,
and that 3.5 inches of fluffy, you've got an R25 wall, and you have a safe wall. That first condensing layer is always going to be above the dew point. You won't have rot issues, and that's a great wall. Instead of a 2x6 with 1 inch, where you're always going to have a first condensing layer that's going to be below the dew point at some point.
And when that gets more dangerous is when you start to get, especially on a new build, and you start to have the trees that are around the site grow up,
yeah,
and get more foliage as time goes on. You're not going to have as much solar drive or drying potential, and so that wall may not fail today, but it's going to fail eventually.
And that solar drive just means the sun hitting the outside, increasing the temperature, which increases the drying potential.
And the one thing that's really important that Peter brought up is the fact that, you know, he has this opportunity to his house is opened up.
Yep.
And so this happens.
Build it back right.
Build it back right, because what so many people do is, like, for replacing a whole roof system, or they have something like this where everything is opened up, this is your opportunity that you're probably not going to get again for several decades.
Yep.
Or
not
ever.
While you own it.
Exactly. So get the assembly right, and
yep.
don't just fill the cavity.
And please use this as a resource. Give us an email or call into the show one weekend, and we'll gladly give you our advice. We have an in-person person here.
A drop-by questionnaire.
What's your name, and how can we help you?
Morning. My name's Tim. My question is, so I have a 100-year-old home. Last winter, we had a lot of challenges with freezing pipes.
Sure.
There's a dirt floor.
Okay.
And it's in Proctor, Vermont, so there's marble block foundation.
Sure. Yep.
Some of those blocks are in less than desirable condition. So
yes.
I guess the question is that some kind of caulking or a cement, or what do I do around those blocks? And then what do I do to help prevent
There's a lot there.
Pipe.
It
yeah.
only sounds like you asked one question, but
yeah.
you really
yes.
asked like four questions.
How thick is the foundation wall, do you think?
Is it 2 footer?
No, way less. Probably 12 inches.
Okay.
Single block.
Okay.
So with that, the R value of that product is probably going to be R1 to R1.5. So it's not an insulated assembly when you have cracks in it as well.
Yeah,
that
we've
makes
seen
it
a lot
worse.
Of those foundations are just not well air sealed, right?
Yes. And so with that, if it presents a smooth surface, a continuously smooth surface, you can use rigid board insulation against that foundation appropriately. But getting it applied is a little bit different, because drilling through marble, we would have a different type of fastener. We'd probably use an adhesive there, and you can get that applied to the wall. But if it's not a smooth surface,
yep.
that's one of those areas where spray foam would
one
be
of the few.
Would be a better
yep.
option
yep.
because it can cover all those gaps and seal it. But by code, and just because it's safe, you need to have an intumescent paint applied or a cementous-based product applied over the foam to keep any fire hazard at bay.
Right, because spray foam itself is a fire hazard. If you can use spray foam, they have a paint that reduces the fire load. Now, you also said, or the
frozen
the damage. You also said there's a dirt floor. So that means
yes.
that you've got constant moisture coming up into that. That needs
yeah.
to be dealt with. You need to get, I would say, get in contact with Matt Clark at Northern Basement Systems. We work with him all the time. We'll find out the best way to keep that moisture down, because that is going to be a durability issue over time.
But with that, some people, we've seen this too often, they'll throw some type of plastic down, and I mean literally throw it down, not make sure it's sealed appropriately, because you want an entire assembly. Think of building a bathtub in your basement, not that you want filled with moisture. You're trying to keep the moisture out. So you would put that covering on the floor, make sure all joints and seams are sealed,
yep.
and also that product is very resilient, some kind of reinforced membrane, and it has some kind of antimicrobial factor on the back side of it, so you don't create a mold factory there. You get that on the floor, bring it up on the walls a little bit, so then when you do spray foam down, you're going to be able to seal that, and so you don't get the moisture migrating upwards. But then you also mentioned that you had frozen pipes.
Where I was going to go the next, yeah.
I am thinking around the beam, probably the box beam, probably an 8-inch by 8-inch box beam, and you probably have the pipes there. Where that becomes a danger of just spray foaming that as well is you shut off the drying plane to the indoors.
To the beam, yeah.
And so what happens is, let's say your siding on the outside is compromised and you don't know it because water's getting behind there. Well, it has many times when you spray foam over it. It loses that ability to dry, and so when it gets wet, it starts to rot it out prematurely. So we've developed a system to where you can use a rock wool type of insulation, a rigid, along that area after it's been air sealed, and then use an intelligent membrane that we talked about before, which allows for drying in both directions. And so that's going to preserve the structure, get it sealed, and stops that cold air from getting in and freezing the pipes again.
So what this is all without eyes on projects.
Exactly.
So first of all, I'd say before you take any of our advice, I'd like to have someone like us actually look at it and confirm that what you've reported to us is what's happening on the ground. But if you have frozen pipes, it means you have freezing conditions, and the freezing conditions is probably due to air infiltration more than anything. You have a leaky basement, you've got these blocks, air's coming through, and that's chilling down the space to where your pipes can freeze. So that is what we'd probably want to look at.
I would agree. Where we see people make errors at times as well is that they'll just spray foam or insulate in front of the pipes. And so what you did even though the pipe is still inside the house, you thermally place
it
outdoors
outside.
So you can accelerate that freezing again. So getting it done right and getting the eyes put on and developing on it and reviewing it and then developing a work scope that's sound is the right thing to do.
Yep.
Well, this is a solution I came up with. So you tell me if I'm off
sure.
base.
Go
sure.
for it.
So I bought pipe wrap.
Sure.
I bought some heated pipe wrap.
Yep.
I bought R90, R19 insulation to put in the basement windows.
Okay.
I was going to fill it in with those, and I was going to use ThoroSeal on the walls.
Okay. So what you've decided to do, what we're recommending is that you make the basement above freezing. And what you decided to do is make the pipe above freezing. So what you're doing is a stopgap, which may work. But if you get down to, 20 degrees, 15 degrees, 10 degrees.
And you lose power,
that's still going to be a problem. If you make the entire basement what we call inside the thermal envelope, you're going to have a number of benefits. First of all, you're going to have better durability. Second of all, the floor of the space above it is going to be warmer because
yes.
you brought it into the thermal envelope. And third of all, you won't have frozen pipes even if you have a loss of power.
And if you start sealing up all the cracks and preventing air infiltration,
yep.
you're going to have a moisture environment in there. So you have the ground open, and you're going to have more moisture in there because you're sealing off some of the ability for it to dry. So that's why sealing that becomes really important,
yep.
in our opinion, certainly.
Yep. So those are the first steps we take. We want to bring the entire basement into the thermal envelope. You're very welcome.
Thanks for stopping by.
I just wanted to point out that we have a celebrity in
Uh-oh.
The room.
There we go.
Current president of the Home Builders Association, Dennis Borbo, has stopped by. He lives further down on Lower Newton Drive here, and we'd just like to say, hey, Dennis, come on over.
He's going to join us on the mic here.
Just for a second.
Well, welcome, everyone. It's great to see Jim and Chris up in our neck of the woods here Woo-hoo! In Franklin County. Their advice is always very well taken, and the education that we need to definitely get out to everyone in the community. And we're glad to have them on the Vermont Builders and Remodelers Association board, and everything that they do good for us. Have a great day.
Great. I don't know if that's Dennis's first time ever on live anything, but it sounds like it. Thank you. Thank you, Dennis, for taking your time out and coming down and saying hi. I want to just throw out some of the information. We're getting to the end of the show, and I wanted to just say, please go on to, if you're interested in this stuff and want to know more about it, we have a number of resources. The YouTube channel, that's youtube.com/C/HouseCallsVermont. You can also do rolls off the tongue. We also have that email, housecallsvt@gmail.com.
Yeah, so if you don't want to call in during the show.
If you're shy like
Dennis.
Yeah,
definitely. You can give us an email. We're definitely going to respond to all of your inquiries
yep.
and possibly use it on air as well.
Yep. So, and if you're interested in that indoor air quality survey, we're probably going to be rolling out the actual survey sometime in December. But we're setting up, we're getting all our ducks in a row, and we're making sure the equipment works right. So please send an email if you'd like to be considered for that. We do have people from last year's survey. We still have your contact information. We will be reaching out about that.
I've never had a person that's done or used one of the indoor air quality monitors not be surprised. And not necessarily
good. That's how poor
the
indoor air quality has been.
So it's worthwhile.
Yeah.
And just putting your head in the sand and saying it doesn't exist, it does exist. So.
Well, there's the great question about when when reality hits our beliefs, right?
Yep.
I believe everything's going fine in my house.
Exactly.
And then you find out the reality. Jim and I are going to be jumping into our cars and driving back down to Essex and working on the tiny house again. So look forward to those tiny house updates. We have an email out to Ethan Waldman, who has he teaches a tiny house down at Yestermorrow.
Yes.
And he's interested in coming and taking a look at what went wrong with this tiny house.
Exactly.
So that we'll be able to share with him what we've found and get his ideas and hear from him. So we'll probably have him on as a guest in the next two or three weeks.
Well, we thank Sticks and Stuff for allowing us to be here today, and certainly come by and check out what they have to offer for all your building projects and weatherization needs. Also, we look forward to being back next week on House Calls Vermont. So until then,
I'm Chris West.
I'm Jim Bradley. See you then.
House Calls Vermont on WDEV, brought to you by RK Miles, a third-generation family-owned business proud to be your local building material supplier. Find a location near you at rkbiles.com. By Poly Construction, for over 30 years, known for anything construction, big or small jobs, one call does it all. POLLIconstruction.com. Ken Libby of the Stowe Area Realty Group at Keller Williams Stowe, your trusted advisor at 802-793-2002. Curtis Lumber with two locations in Vermont, Williston and Burlington. Request a quote for your next project online at curtislumber.com. By Sticks and Stuff and Swanton Lumber, with locations in St. Albans, Enosburg, Swanton, Derby, and Middlesex. And Shamrock Painting, painting and custom wood finishing. ShamrockPainting.com. And by Matt Clark's Northern Basement Systems, for all things basement-y. NorthernNEFoundations.com. Be sure to join us again next Saturday at 12:30 during the noon hour for House Calls Vermont.